Some situations are really complex. I mean, really complex. Things don't always work out as you wish they would. John was driving home late one night when he picked up a hitchhiker. And as they rode along, he began to be suspicious of his passenger. And John checked to see if his wallet was still in the pocket of his coat that was on the seat there between him, but it wasn't there. So he slammed on the brakes, ordered the hitchhiker out, and said, "Hand over the wallet immediately." The hitchhiker slowly handed over a billfold, and John drove off. When he arrived home, he started to tell his wife about the experience, but she interrupted him, saying, "Before I forget, John, before I forget, you know you left your wallet at home this morning." Things don't always work out like you wish they would. Some jokes don't always work out like we wish they would. Preaching a sermon that deals with propriety in worship, specifically how we present ourselves, including how women present themselves in worship at this particular moment in history, is likely not an enviable position for anyone. Nevertheless, it's in the Bible, so we don't run from that which is contained in Scripture, and since my name is in the bulletin, I suppose it's my task to tackle it. I told a friend last week I felt like I had drawn the short straw in preaching. I'm kidding, sort of. But here's what I mean. We're going to be looking this morning at a passage of Scripture that some people might read and think is certainly sexist. For the record, it's not. We'll be talking about both genders, but I know that not everybody will tune in for the entirety of the sermon and may end up checking out before they realize that the sermon in no way is picking on women. Further, some people would see this text as insensitive in light of our current cultural condition. You guys know I'm never one to shy away from tackling what the Scripture has to say. However, given this current moment in our culture, I find myself even more sensitive to how things might be perceived, and that's probably not a bad thing. So let me say at the outset of our time together this morning that while I most certainly want to be sensitive in this cultural moment, I recognize no one in our church family wants that desired sensitivity on my part to keep me from telling the truth related to a biblical text. That would be neither honest nor helpful. So I'm going to tell the truth to the best of my ability and hopefully keep the emphasis where it needs to be. That is my prayer this morning, and that has certainly been my prayer in preparation for preaching today. What we'll be addressing needs careful attention, and it may seem a bit methodical and plodding at times, because frankly, it is. So listen to the end, if you will, and give this preacher the benefit of the doubt. And if you find yourself getting edgy at any point and you don't like what I say, Travis Black's email is in the bulletin. We continue our series called To Be Saints Together. We find ourselves in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and we'll begin reading with the second verse this morning, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning with verse 2, and I'll invite you to stand, please, for the reading of God's Word. Paul writes as follows, "Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you, but I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman, for a woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him, but if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. And Travis's email is in the bulletin. You may be seated. Now, you understand, I trust, why I said what I said in the beginning. It's not likely too many people want to stand up, especially not right now, and say to the women in our church, here's the way you should wear your hair. In fact, I've made it a practice to never comment on any female's appearance except a woman whose name is Lori and has the last name Parker. Now, I do have a granddaughter. I don't know if you guys know that I'm a grandpa or not. In case you don't, I am, and I have a granddaughter, and I will admit that as a doting granddad, I feel completely at ease telling my little sweetheart how cute she is and how much her grandpa loves her. And I've told my son, if anyone ever breaks her heart, I'll send him to meet Jimmy Hoffa. I've lived a good life. So we could likely talk about this forever. Certainly the biblical text has yielded countless pages of ink on paper, and I'm sure that I won't answer all of your questions this morning. I'll recommend what I found to be a helpful resource. In addition to my regular commentary work, the resource is a book by Philip B. Payne entitled Man and Woman, One in Christ, An Exegetical and Theological Study of Paul's Letters. It's a tremendously helpful resource. I don't agree with everything Payne says. You likely won't either, but it's a good resource. In context, this section of Paul's letter is written about protocols in public worship, how the people of God should present themselves as worship occurs. Now, don't panic. This is not a sermon about suits and ties and blue jeans and t-shirts, and I'm not even going to mention anything about cufflinks. It's not about ball caps on boys either. Rather, it's a discourse that is very timely in this moment in our world. Paul is going to deal with how men and women should present themselves in accordance with cultural norms, provided these cultural norms maintain the distinctions between the two sexes, and how in so doing it speaks volumes about respect and authority. So here we go. Number one, there is an importance attached to relationships within the faith. There is an importance attached to relationships within the faith. Verse 2 and following, Paul says, now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Paul begins by praising the Corinthians because they are holding firmly to what he refers to as the traditions, lest you think of tradition as the way we perceive this in our modern sensibilities. Let me hasten to say that it is different than that. In this context, the traditions about which Paul is speaking, the traditions were the oral teaching, the spiritual instruction that the people were holding to, even as Paul has instructed them, and now he is offering praise for doing so. That's important. That's important in part because, as we've read at times, we've noted that the words of praise from Paul to the people at Corinth have been few and far between. Now we move to talk about some things that not everyone in our culture, in fact, not everyone in the church universal even, will readily grasp. Paul moves now to speak of the fact that Christ is the head of man is the head of woman, and God is the head of Christ. So what in the world is all this about? Well, it's important to recognize that the real intent of verse 3 is to highlight how covering one's head is indicative of the relationships within the church. Let me again remind you that I'll be utilizing a lot of material from the book that I mentioned earlier. For the sake of time, I'm not going to reference the book every time I allude to an idea that leapt from its pages. And if you'll excuse me, I've got a wire I've got to fix. I feel better. Suffice it to say, Paul isn't trying to prove these relationships exist. That they exist is a given. Instead, what he's going to address is the shameful way some men, and in fact some women, cover or don't cover their heads, especially in worship at the time of his writing. Paul introduces these relationships that the actions of covering or not covering one's head will affect. In each case, he's talking about Christ as the head of man or man as the head of woman, etc. He is metaphorically using the word translated head. Some will talk about this as authority. Some will talk about this as source. So what does he mean here? Suffice it to say, according to Payne, scholarship in recent years has shifted the understanding of the word translated head to mean source rather than authority. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this. One main reason is the number of translators who do not see the word head as an appropriate word to convey leadership. In fairness, if you read two scholars about this, you're likely to get four opinions. Now, what I'm about to say in no way is meant to downplay what I believe is to be the role of men in leadership in their homes, in the church, and in the culture. I believe that men are, in fact, supposed to be the spiritual head, the spiritual leaders, the spiritual authority in their homes. But in this text, I generally lean towards source rather than authority. Not because I have a liberal agenda behind what I'm thinking, but rather because of the context. The idea of source makes good sense here. It's logical. Look again, the source of every man is Christ, the source of every wife is her husband, and the source of Christ is God, as in God the Father. It's important to note here that this can be a husband and wife, as you have read it. We've seen this already. It can also simply mean man and woman. It's not necessarily husband and wife. It can also mean man and woman. There's no article, so think there's no word his before wife. It doesn't say his wife. Paul isn't necessarily saying a husband and wife then. It can be man and it can be woman, which I believe would give credibility to the concept of source being a better translation than authority. It makes no sense to say that the authority over your wife is another man who's in no way related to you, not her boss, not her pastor, not her anything. So I think source fits. The source of every man is Christ, but Christ is not the leader of every man. So again, I see source as being a helpful understanding here. The source of every man is Christ, but Christ is not the authority of every man. What I mean is, we know there are those who now, these days, do not place themselves under the authority of Christ. So while Christ is not the leader of every man, Christ is the source of every man. And of course, we know that one day everyone will in fact acknowledge that Christ is authoritative over the entirety of the universe. But not everybody does that now. Further then, man is the source of woman. That's true in the created order of things. And Paul will further appeal to this notion just a bit later. But let me ask, from where did woman originate? This is why the issue of what we believe related to creation is so vitally important. We need to believe the biblical account of how all of this started, lest we miss some really important things from that moment forward. She came from man. Remember? Remember? God created woman out of man. So in that sense, man is the source of woman. And of course, God is the source of Christ in the sense that God the Son is sent by the Father and that He came from the Father in His coming to earth. Now, Philip Payne has some 15 reasons to favor source as the understanding of this over authority, but I know this is probably a preacher thing, and it probably doesn't mean a whole lot to you guys, and some of you need to get home to watch The Curse of Oak Island anyway. So there's an importance attached to relationships within the faith. Number two, there is proper presentation for worship. Verse 4 and following, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, but every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. There is a proper presentation for worship. Now, Paul talks negatively about a man praying or prophesying with his head covered, and he speaks negatively about a woman praying or prophesying without her head covered. What in the world is this all about? You may or may not be aware that this is a concept about which there are varying opinions. My dad was led to Christ by a young man who was a leader in a house church movement. And when their church gathered for worship in the houses, not all, but most of the ladies would wear a head covering, a garment, if you will, a head covering of some type. It was their belief that what Paul says here was a universal command and not necessarily related to culture. Others obviously interpret this as more related to Paul's culture than to a universal command. In many ways, that is the crux of the issue here. Is this a universal command or a command Paul issues based on something happening in Corinthian culture at the time? Now, this may seem a little bit cumbersome, but we're going somewhere with all of this. So stay with me. By the way, when a preacher says, stay with me, he's already admitting he's lost them. Look at verse 4 again. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. The phrase, with his head covered, is literally, in the original language, it literally is having down alongside the head. Having down alongside the head. So that's been translated to talk about with his head covered. Why? Because people wanted that to make sense for English readers. So what is down alongside the head that's a problem? What's the big deal about this? Well, some people will talk about the practice of pulling down the toga or the robe sort of thing under or over the head while bowing for pagan worship. They would say that for a Christian to do that, like the pagans did, that would be imitating a pagan practice, and therefore that would be the thing that would be a disgrace. Well, admittedly, that could be it. But I don't think that's it. I think there's a better explanation at this point. Think in terms of what could be disgraceful for men as part of their leadership and worship at Corinth at that time. I think Paul identifies, in fact, I know Paul identifies what the disgrace is. He identifies it in verse 14, where he writes, "Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him?" Now, everybody catch your breath. Stay with me to the end, okay? Because here's the thing. Contrary to what you may think, Paul couldn't care less about men wearing long hair. That's not the issue. It's connected to how they wear their long hair, if, in fact, they have long hair. It's connected to the rationale or the reason why the men would have long hair. I remember when I served as a young worship leader in a church some 30 years ago, and my hair was longer, in fact, much longer. I had much more of it. It was brown, and I miss it. But I remember one lady saying to our senior pastor, "I like Ken. I think he's a good young man, but what about that hair?" I personally think she was just jealous. I tell you that because I want to refute what some people thought and what some people still think about men with long hair. When I wore my hair long in those days, do you know what kind of a statement I was making? Do you know what I was saying by wearing that long hair? What kind of a statement was I making? I wasn't making any statement. I just liked my hair longer. It was the culture. It was the style in those days. In Corinth, if the history that is reported is right, a man wearing long hair and fixing it a certain way at that time was making a statement. We know that we cannot say universally that long hair on men is sinful. Do you guys remember the Nazarite vow? One of the aspects of that vow was that a Nazarite was not to cut his hair for the length, for the duration of the vow. Well, that would likely mean some long hair, and that would include men having long hair. And even though most of us grew up seeing a depiction of Jesus with blonde hair and blue eyes, he was Jewish, you know. Based on his race and his homeland, he probably was a whole lot darker skinned than you would have ever imagined and wouldn't have worn a crew cut. To the point, these facts demonstrate that the disgrace of long hair on a man had to be connected to a particular context. It certainly wasn't a disgrace to the Nazarite, nor was it a disgrace to men like John the Baptist, who likely had, based on what we read, a bit of a disheveled look. I think John would scare most Baptists half to death if we'd seen him. So how does this even fit? Well, let me give you a quote from the book I referenced earlier. Philip Payne notes, and I quote, "Greek, Roman, and Jewish literature of Paul's day frequently speaks of men wearing long, effeminate hair as disgraceful, especially when done up like a woman's hair. In that context, the idea of a man's hair being done up like a woman entailed a man presenting himself more like a woman, being effeminate." Effeminate, by definition, simply means made woman-ish. So, in several works, H. Herder, as example, documents the moral indignation over effeminate hairstyles by men with over 100 references to effeminate hair from classical antiquity, the greatest number coming from around, here it is, Paul's time. As several sources from the time of Paul note, many men desiring homosexual liaisons advertised their sexual availability through a display of effeminate hair. So what about long hair on men today? In keeping with the logic that we have laid out thus far, unless a man is wearing long hair in a style that is presenting himself as effeminate, unless he's wearing his hair that way to appear to favor the look of a woman more than a man, unless he is wearing long hair, presenting himself as provocative and effeminate to invite homosexual encounters, it's fine. There are countless men I know who have worn long hair, and they don't look effeminate. In fact, I wouldn't pick a fight with them if my life depended on it. And the last thing they would entertain is a homosexual tryst. So long hair in Corinth in Paul's day, worn by men to appear as female or to invite homosexual activity, is universally condemned. Long hair on men who still present themselves as masculine, I don't think is condemned. Now, let's talk about skinny jeans. Are you guys as tired as I am? I know you are. I'm really trying. Paul would condemn men in the church trying to appear like women. He would say, men, are you ready? Men should present like men. Women should present like women. Thankfully, Paul and his companions were able to squelch all gender bending in that day, so we don't have to deal with it any longer. Well, let's talk about what Paul talks about next. He says, a wife or woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, and it's as if she might as well shave her head. And culturally, a woman with a shaved head in that day would have been either a feminist or a prostitute. If the traditional idea of a garment covering the female's head in worship is to be the universal church custom, we have to square that with several other things that Paul says, and the truth is, you really can't do that. For example, he says at the beginning of chapter 11, now I commend you because you maintain the traditions. So if this was supposed to be a universal custom, then they were getting it right already, so why would Paul go on to give further instruction? In 11:3, he says, but I want you to understand. That implies Paul is introducing something new. It really wouldn't make sense that Paul would introduce a universal custom as something new to a church where he had ministered so long, and he already said they were to be commended for following what he's taught. If Paul's point were that a woman should cover her head with a garment, why would he say that her hair was her glory? Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 11:15 that a woman's long hair is her glory and given her for a covering doesn't connect well with the argument that she has to wear a garment head covering. Why would she need to cover what was given to her already for a covering? So then, what does it mean for a woman to have her head uncovered? There are mainly two answers scholars will offer. One is the idea that uncovered would mean without a garment over the head. Another idea would be to see a woman's head as covered if she had done up, as we mentioned earlier, if she had put her hair up, done up her hair over her head, either wound around or held up with a ribbon or a clip and so forth. In this case, then, uncovered would be referring to a woman letting her hair hang down loosely around her shoulders in worship. A lot of scholars will make a case for the second concept, that in the culture at Corinth at the time, uncovered would mean that the woman's hair was just hanging down loosely. Well, why would that be a problem? Because most of the portraits and the frescoes and the sculptures and vase paintings in Greek and Roman cities of Paul's day almost universally depicted respectable women with their hair up. Cultural. So the Corinthians would have likely agreed, especially in worship, that a woman praying or prophesying in the church with her hair hanging down loosely would have been shameful. Remember, respectable, hair up. Shameful, hair down. It's likely, scholars note, that it would be embarrassing and an affront to a husband for a woman in worship to wear her hair loosely hanging down. It was often, in fact, seen as the wife's repudiation of sexual fidelity to her husband. She wore her hair down loosely to demonstrate she wasn't faithful. To the point, culturally, at the time of Paul's writing, it is likely that some women wore their hair down to demonstrate their rebellion and openness to revelry. Again, lots changed in 2,000 years. If the head covering, then, is strictly a garment, and that is a possibility, certainly in that culture, a married woman who uncovered her head in public worship would have brought shame to her husband. It could have been seen as an openness to immorality or as a sign, even, of not being married. Again, bear in mind that was some 2,000 years ago. Culturally, it's not the same as it is today. The question really is, are you presenting yourself as the gender with which God has created you, and are you doing anything that demonstrates to our culture an openness to immorality? Now, let me encourage you. There are differing views on these issues. I think, given the chasm of time that we have to cross in order to get to Paul, we ought to be charitable toward one another. This is not an area of theology that should cause Christians to break fellowship. Live your convictions and be tolerant of those with differing convictions. If you're a woman and you want to cover your head, by all means, do it. If you're a man and you want to wear long hair, do it. Just don't be a sissy about it. There's an importance attached to relationships within the faith. There is a proper presentation for worship. Number three, there are meaningful theological implications related to how we present ourselves. There are meaningful theological implications related to how we present ourselves. Verse 6 and following, "For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God." Most of what Paul now moves to say in these particular verses, we've dealt with in our time already, with a couple of extra thoughts needed. First of all, what's the deal with the symbol of authority because of the angels in verse 10? It's kind of like we're reading along, and then all of a sudden, boom, Paul hits us with this angel thing. What is that all about? Well, simply put, some will see the symbol of authority as needing to be a garment for head covering. Some people see that. Others will see the symbol of authority as being a woman's hair and the way, in particular, she wears her hair. Just so we're clear, and I know this is complicated, the words symbol of, that we read in our English translations are not in the original language. They were put in place as an interpretation device to explain that the head covering symbolizes being under authority. The Greek text would simply read, "That is why a woman or wife ought to have authority on her head. So what's the big deal then about because of the angels? First, remember, we believe there are, in fact, angels in the world. In fact, the book of Hebrews reminds us that we might be entertaining angels and not even be aware of it. This text would indicate that angels who observe the conduct of Christians in worship would take offense at men and women not presenting themselves properly, that is, gender bending, among other things, not presenting themselves properly in worship. You see, how we present ourselves in worship really is important. But let's be clear, this is not about suits versus jeans or skirts versus slacks. It's about presenting oneself without seeking to be a distraction to the gathered assembly. Some of the men and women at the time in Corinth were flaunting their rebellion and flaunting their openness to immorality. While we may not get the same exact connotation in today's culture with hairstyles, clothing is in fact a reflection of one's view of himself or herself. So those who are part of leading ought to be mindful of how we present ourselves. Proper decorum is important. I would simply offer that both men and women should dress in a way that they're not being provocative in any way. Modesty is the biblical key for both men and women. And I know this, that oftentimes people point out the provocative dress of women to the neglect of pointing out the same for men. Just as women should seek to avoid becoming an object for sexual attention in worship, so should men. Nobody needs to see a man's chest hair or bulging biceps in worship. I just offended half of the church planters in America. Not to mention all the charismatics. Oh, just breathe, people. We're almost done. That's why I wear a suit, so you guys don't see my bulging biceps. That wasn't funny. Can we finish this, please? So further, let me hasten to say contextually, this is about people who are praying or prophesying in worship. This is about people who are helping to lead worship. So while modesty and proper decorum would be great across the board, we think everybody in the church ought to practice modesty. Paul makes the distinction related to those who are leading. So the practical takeaway is this, and please don't miss this. If a kid comes into worship in a ball cap, don't chastise him. That's cultural. That's not biblical. Now, I know I grew up, my dad said, you take off your hat when you walk into a building, and certainly you take off your hat when you walk into a church, etc., but that's cultural. That's not biblical. Instead of making a big deal about that and potentially making the kid feel turned away by the church, why don't you befriend him and just sit down next to him, so if somebody who's kind of like the church lady on Saturday Night Live starts to give ugly looks, he'll at least feel like he's got one person in the room that's kind. If someone comes in wearing a Bud Light t-shirt or something that's showing too much skin, don't blast him or her. Befriend them. Love them. Look them in the eye and let them know you're looking them only in the eye, and share the love of Jesus with them. And walk with them from where they are over time to the place of experiencing the transformation that only Jesus can bring. We should all be mature enough in our faith not to be offended by something like that. So there's an importance attached to relationships within the faith. There is a proper presentation for worship. There are meaningful theological implications related to how we present ourselves. Fourthly and finally and gratefully, there is an argument from nature related to how we present ourselves. There's an argument from nature related to how we present ourselves. Verse 13, judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? Remember the context. But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. Paul says that nature, in fact, explains that which he's written. It explains what we've talked about. But what nature means here is that really all of this should be self-evident. Should be. But we know it's not. The point is that those leading worship in particular should present themselves in such a way that they demonstrate they are seeking to live under the authority of Jesus. Now, I thought about what illustration to close with, but never came up with a good one. So instead, I thought I'd put the names of all the hairstylists from our church on the screen. And if you believe that, you probably believe the weathermen too.